Welcome to Prosody, 90.5 FM's weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. I'm Renee Alberts, guest host of Prosody, and my guest is the poet Adriana Ramirez. Adriana E. Ramirez is a nonfiction writer and performance poet with over 15 years' experience in theater, spoken word, and advocacy. Once ranked the 26th slam poet in the world, she helped found and co-hosted the Latino Indigenous Showcase at the National Poetry Slam. She now serves as creative director of Pittsburgh Poetry Collective and slam master of the Steel City Slam. She currently works as a lecturer in creative writing, literature, and composition at the University of Pittsburgh, where she is finishing a book about the Colombian Civil War known as The Violence. She has an MFA in nonfiction writing from Pitt and a BA from Rice University. Hi, thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you so much for having me. I really appreciate getting to be here.
Sure. Do you want to start us off with some poems?
Yeah, absolutely. It's called Just a Burger. Behind the counter of the Just a Burger, where fair is fair and right is right around the corner, sits you, operator of fry-frying vat mechanisms at this burger joint. I enter, wanting only a 99-cent burger and nothing else. You scowl at me as you realize no one else can take my order and you're forced to leave your post as the fryer fries to attend the customer. What do you want? A burger. Just a burger. And then I giggle at you because the name of the place is Just a Burger, but you don't find me funny. Then before I can decide, your fry fryer beeps and you flee to cajole the oil into slowly residing, and with delicate care you glide on your gloves, and as if you carried a child, the fry fryer warms to the fire in your eyes. Knobs shift and your back hunches over the shaker. You are the mad taker of fried chances, and your grim stance is calling to me, but my calling is a quarter pound of ground chuck grease, which pounds my hunger, grounding my slow desire, fueling the fire for an all-beef patty. Yet your back backs me into the corner past the right cash register where I focus on the smooth attention you pay to newly fried freedom fries, and suddenly I am enslaved by this paid care, and before I can pay for my wares, I must wait for your return. So, just a burger? No, I would also like some fries. And then you, fryer fries at the Just a Burger on 290, see my change of heart and gaze at me slowly as the glaze of newfound awe fills the fair irises where fair is fair and right is left of the counter where the customer stands taken with the operator fry-frying vat mechanisms. That'll be 214, but 214 rings up more like, I love you. And we stand, staring at each other, formica stretching between us, and as I hand you my $5 bill, our hands caress, but no longer wanting just a burger, but instead a fryer of fries and a paying customer at the Just a Burger where fair is fair and right is left of the order here sign, and my thumb releases the bill into your fry oil calloused hands. The ding of the register briefly breaks the spell as we register the length of our mutual silence. You hand me $2 and some coins, breathlessly say, thank you for having more at Just a Burger. Here's your change. Sighing heavily and dreading your return to the fryer fries and wishing you could care for me as such, I whisper thanks. But I've got all the change I need, which rings up a little more like, I love you too, fryer fries, the Just a Burger off of 290. This is The Diva's Prayer, and it is written for Amy Winehouse and Whitney Houston. Lord, if I die young and famous, let me die at 27. Let them find me asleep like so many have been found. Lord, if I'm asleep, I hope I'm not naked. And if I'm naked, please make sure I've at least been hit in the gym. What I mean to say, Lord, is don't let me die ugly. Don't let them see what the crack has done to my teeth or hear what it's done to my voice. Lord, if I die young and famous, let me die at 27. Let them find me asleep like so many have been found. I don't want to be old, slip away in a bathtub, a life exchanged for an ephemeral sparkle, forever reaching for something I lost at the bottom of a flask years ago. Oh, Lord, I know I'm a sinner. But when I'm bad, I know I'm better. No one loves me like you, not even my daddy, but he thinks I'm fine. When all I got is a pocket flap of disappointment stitched on my heart, the death rattle of the last pill in the bottle, I keep singing to the moon, Lord, about the old days. I was beautiful then. And that moment when my throat unleashed a prayer so pure it could only be called song. Well, even the white boys say nothing gold can stay. And Lord, I know I'm platinum. I put the divine in diva. I'm the queen of the night, and you keep trying to rehab my soul, but I say no, no. No, I will not sink, Lord. I will not warble. I will hit every note of self-destruction perfectly, like an angel, like the box office depended on it. if I die young and famous. Let me die at 27, let them find me asleep, like so many have been found, but I changed my mind. Let me be naked, Lord. Let me be beautifully naked for the lens, the tabloid, and the checkout machine. Let them look upon the scratches and bruises their focused stares have wrought. Let them look upon my body, my work, my sins, and despair. Lord, if I die, let them see it all.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Renee Alberts, and my guest is the poet Adriana Ramirez, reading from her work. One of the things that I'd like to ask you about in your poems is the element of surprise. You have a lot of surprising imagery. I mean, you have the surprising sort of premise of the Just a Burger poem with the person, you know, falling in love with the fry fryer. But you also have some really nice surprise in the lines that you use, like, don't let me die ugly, and like some of the imagery. Can you talk about how you cultivate some of that?
Well, Just a Burger, hilariously, was written after Alexander Pope's The Rape of the Lock. And so there's this sort of element of taking a word from a line and punning it up, if you will, or exploring the different meanings of it. And so I got obsessed with this idea. And so I started thinking about writing a very kind of traditional romantic poem that sort of emulated some of the formal structures of, like, 16th or 17th century poetry, and then it ended up going in a completely different space. But I really like the idea of, you know, the register allowing us to register mutual silence and the ding of the register, the actual sound of it. And it's a lot about playfulness and playing through the language and sort of circling back and back over just this tiny moment, right? Can I have a burger? Yes, it's $2.14. Thank you, pay, gone. Right, and trying to turn this very mild thing into this epic love story that, you know, happens in an instant. And in the other poem, a lot of it is, you know, lines ripped from their music, right? So, you know, I'm the queen of the night, very recognizable Whitney Houston moment, right? You keep trying to rehab my soul, and I say, no, right? Very Amy Winehouse, you know, incorporating things like Sparkle, which I know is Whitney Houston's last film, or you know, when I'm bad, I know I'm better,
right?
Which is also, you know, Whitney Houston music. And so it's one of those poems that for me is about sort of, it's like Easter eggs, right? You find it and you get to open it up, and it's a nice surprise for the initiated, and for the uninitiated, I hope that it's woven in a way that it still kind of brings up the pathos of, you know, what it means to be a diva and just be so dramatic and big.
Yeah. Those are two very, very intentional approaches to writing a poem where you incorporate this whole other element. Is that common to the way that you compose?
Yes.
Yeah?
I start with structure. So that's the very first thing I do, is I come up with a structure of what it's going to look like and how it's going to play out. And then usually I'll have one line that is just sort of the seed line, and it's never the opening line. So in this case, actually, it was this notion of not dying naked, right, for me, which was how embarrassing, right, to die naked. And everyone gets to see you, and there's no dignity in that. You can't really hold it in because, you know, you're dead. Well, that sounds flippant, but what I mean to say is that there's a vulnerability, I think, and to imagining Whitney Houston passing away the way she did in a bathtub, and, you know, just thinking about myself in a bathtub and just being like, oh gosh, I hope no one finds me like this. And that was really the genesis of the whole thing.
Well, what you're describing is interesting because it sounds like you progressed from this idea of a structure, which I think some people would think of as kind of something colder, but what you're talking about in the poem is something that has a lot of empathy and a lot of...
Well, I think the prayer form allows for that, right? And it is a prayer. And so I wanted to kind of think, you know, what would I pray about? I knew I wanted to write a prayer. And so if I were a celebrity who had, you know, who was on the verge of imploding, what would I pray for? And so it's a little bit where the form might seem cold, but a prayer is so inherently empathetic. You know, you can't, and it forces you to reflect on yourself in a very honest way. You're talking to God, right?
Yeah.
You're not talking to your therapist. You're not talking to your parole officer. You're not talking to the tabloids. You know, it's you and God. And I think that when you're doing that, it allows you to have this intimacy.
and this immediacy. It's urgent.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, right? It does and have so, that in the poem.
And performance poetry is inherently immediate, right? People don't get the chance to linger on the page. And so because when you read it out loud, you want your audience to identify what you're doing quickly and to understand and to identify. Mm-hmm. And so these types of structures allow me to do that and to really kind of pack a bigger emotional punch because I'm not worried about, you know, what I'm going to do at the end or how I'm going to wrap up.
Right. I'd like to talk to you a little bit more about audience, but can you read us some more poems first?
Yes. Little baby plants are starting to push through the brown muck. It feels a little like the earth is pulling away from me, not that things are growing through it. And I know I can either give up who I am or hold on to whatever it is I have. I'm just not sure which is more valuable. I want to reinvent myself as a concept, something with a lot of potential, like a 7-foot-tall gypsy. A white one, of course. I want to be a carny from Belgrade who's allergic to rice pilaf, but not rice or pilaf. It's like falling apart has become my normal weather forecast. Today, 60% chance I'll hit the wall so hard on purpose I accidentally bruise my wrist. Tomorrow, 30% chance that mantras will fail and I'll have to resort to camp songs. Down in the jungle where nobody goes, there's a wishy-washy washerwoman washing her clothes. She goes, ooh, ah. Ooh, ah, and that's how the washerwoman slowly commits suicide at the mendacity of her existence. They don't teach you that last part at Rotary Youth Minority Summer Leadership Experience Academy. Camp. I'm running out of excuses to hate myself. You're okay, I say, but even the fake version of me that smiles in the mirror doesn't believe it. I'm getting worse at returning phone calls and better at listening to recordings of famous actors reading romance novels in the bathtub. My mother doesn't know what to call what I have. I hate to tell her it's failure. I'm not sure she's comfortable looking at such things. I'm not sure what the best kind of glue is to put together a jigsawed organ. It's like my whole life I've been looking for a place to live, a home. And everywhere I look, the houses simply conform how not normal I am, and I don't look like the neighbors, and I don't like taking the stairs. The parking lot is always too far away. I'll need a bigger place. My different gendered personalities cannot sleep in the same room according to the law. I need a 3-bedroom in a 2-bedroom world. And I don't understand. I don't understand why all the houses were built for bodies unlike mine, why I can't write a letter and get the landlord to build a ramp that accommodates all my crazy. I feel a little like the planet is sinking beneath me. Not that I'm outgrowing it. It feels a little like my heart puzzle is missing a piece. And yes, now that I've counted twice, so's the Scrabble bag. Who takes a letter? Who would be so careless to lose a letter? But it's spring, and I gotta get out of this funk, this life, this lack of money, this overwhelming sensation of drowning, this underwhelming desire to over-medicate my way through my iCalendar's reminder list. I on we, I didn't take the cookie from the cookie jar, and in fact, I know who did. The washerwoman in the jungle. And she's wishy-washing all the pretension away with an ooh and an ah, and I'm a baby plant pushing through the muck and I'm raking dirt off my leaves and I'm dancing for sun and rain and everything that nature's got to throw at me, and I'm hoping that growth hurts less than wanting in this secluded jungle. I hope I'm not one of the thousands of seeds that never knows the soil is poisoned against them. I hope that Scrabble letter is buried in the ground, that it'll grow and sprout words for me, raw ones, ones that solder hearts back together, white words, the kind that special hurt. I count on the promise of spring and search for a house where I'll finally feel at home. That's called Spring. This one is called The Simile Like You. We drive along a highway in Indiana, snow on the ground, sunglassed and pure like a Tuesday. And inside my head there's a swelling, inside my head stuff's about to burst. And there's a crisis on the left, a woman plowed in the pink clay, a child forgotten for 7 hours at soccer, a fat man scream like a feathered snake coated in salt, like a tracked mark, seconds before we all slide up half-burnt anyway. Like my eyebrows are fire, and the lashes small fans, and your eyes, baby, smell like kindling. So what I'm trying to say is that my facial hair has depreciated, my left ventricle's been remodeled, my esophagus got new locks, and my gizzard's turned into pie, because no one makes pie sleep on the couch. And I like you, like bananas and underwear, like television on my skin before breakfast, like you bought me scissors and a dotted line, showed me how destruction meant order, how sweet fruit, even when crushed, can't recover, but it always tastes better broken, like monkeys watching us at the zoo, like butter on a pine tree, like a museum when you kick it, like a smile on an unfortunate woman, we're improbable. And I like you like me, like looking liking loves, but this stuff's about to burst. And teeth that look like daggers usually are, but I kissed you anyway and told you I believed in astrology so you'd give me a moon, settling for a lunar pod, because hell, this economy is terrible, and Indiana's looking more and more like my life than any other wasteland these days. So you were naked, and I laughed at you, called you my little goat monster. But that's just because beauty is hilarious, like talking to a face on a magazine or an advertisement for Liquid Joy. What I meant to say is that you look like all the Happy Meals I coveted as a child. Like feather, rope, and glue, like a computer underwater, like sanity and ketchup, like everything else so familiar and impossible and real, like blood, like sandwiches, like a blind bird sculpted, like sand, like my heart in your breaking hand. And one day, it'll be us. Two human beings with belly fat and a keen sense of humor actually walking away, like two flirting chassis passing one another on a highway in Indiana. And for a second, the disco funk dance track will skip, and my voice, as I sing along, will hit the one note that makes me thirsty like a Bloody Mary for you. And when I look over, you'll be gone. And I'll wonder if you existed, if you stepped out for fuel in a stretch, your plates clattering as the landscape consumed you like all the roads we've traveled do. But baby, this burst. And I wonder if you were ever really there, like a bridge after fire, like words, like love, like this highway in Indiana.
If you've just tuned in, you're listening to Prosody. I'm Renee Alberts, and my guest is the poet Adriana Ramirez. So I do want to go back to the idea of the audience.
Yeah.
I think that spoken word and slam have a sort of fascinating paradox in that you know when you're writing them that you're not going to have the distance that somebody who's writing something for the page might have when the audience encounters it. You're going to be right there in front of them. And you mentioned before that you're very purposeful about having an element of intimacy and being aware of immediacy. And so I'm curious about how the knowledge that of the audience influences your writing.
Well, I think the most important element is that when I say I in a poem, and I'm standing in front of you on stage, I am the I. And I think that on the page, you can give yourself permission to have a persona or be a little different, or nobody looks at you and go, ah, you are the I. But on stage saying, yeah, I loved you, right? I'm the one. And so I'm very conscious and aware of who I am almost as a character. Mm. And it's important to me to kind of share that vulnerability with the audience. And so my poems are very autobiographical, and I try to make myself as comfortable as I can being that I.
Why is that vulnerability important to you?
Well, it's why I do this. I do this because I'm nervous about the idea of somebody picking this up and actually reading it. But getting on stage and performing it, I get to control it.
Oh.
I get to control how it sounds. I get to control when I'm loud or when I'm soft, or, you know, when I'm looking at somebody directly, mm-hmm. when I kind of zone out, blank out a little. These are all purposeful moves that you can't necessarily do on the page. And so when I write, and I write intending for performance, there are, it would be a little awkward to have a carrot on the page that says, say this loud, right? Say this soft. Slow down the pace here. This is meant to speed up and kind of, there's a funky thing I do structurally toward the end where I start to build momentum,
mm-hmm.
right? Because I want the poem to have that kind of vocal variety that I don't think you can necessarily do on the page. On the page, you can't tell your reader, read fast here. So I really appreciate that. And it allows me to kind of think of my poetry in the more theatrical sense, right? And kind of going back to, you know, oral tradition, the origins of it. Troubadours going from town to town. And the reason poems rhymed was because they were easier to memorize. And the reason that we went town to town and, you know, spoke these memorized rhyming passages was to continue the stories of ourselves and getting to see ourselves in stories and, you know, casting yourself as an epic hero in some cases, or being acutely aware of your failures in others, but sharing these stories with your community and your people. And so for me, that's what slam is about, in addition to the competition aspect, of course. But at its core, it's about getting up on stage and sharing something and being present in it and forcing people to look at you and be present with you.
And I've seen you read, and I've seen some videos of you mm-hmm. reading, and you can hear there's an audible audience response.
I hope so.
Of people reacting, people laughing in parts. One other thing that I wanted to ask you about was the humor in your poems. You have these moments of, in the Just a Burger one of 214 reads more like I love you.
Mm-hmm.
And like there are just these funny moments that come up. And I wanted to ask you about humor because I think that humor is a tricky thing to pull off in writing.
My humor is always inappropriate. I am the kind of person who cracks jokes at funerals. Mm-hmm. It's a defense mechanism, and it's how I see myself as just a ridiculous human being. And I understand the absurdity of the human condition. And if you actually think about what falling in love is, it's absurd, right? And if you think about heartbreak, or you think about, you know, wanting to be famous, or even just anything, right? Neuroses. It's ridiculous that we feel all these things, and they're so intense, and we care so much about them. And so I think stopping and laughing about it, it not only breaks tension, which I like. So when things get a little heady and people are looking for an escape valve, right? And laughter allows you to do that. And I like giving people permission to laugh at things that shouldn't be funny. I find that to be really important, because it allows us to have a sense of humor about all the things and not take ourselves so seriously. And yet, sometimes in that moment of humor, something even more serious is unearthed underneath that. And I particularly enjoy that, you know, in saying things like, you know, no one makes pie sleep on the couch.
Yeah, right.
Right? It's a silly image, but it also reveals a lot of anxiety about, you know, who is forced to sleep on the couch?
Yeah.
And why do we reject some things and not others? And you know, and there's a sadness to it. I'm going to turn my stomach into pie so you don't make me sleep somewhere else, right? Is really what it's saying, but it's saying it in a way that's absurd. So it, I don't know. It's a tension.
That makes sense. Can you read us some more poems?
It's been over 6 years and Celia Cruz is still dead. She was a queen in a world of councils and dictators when a king was a promoter and champions were chattel. Ali and Foreman, 1974, Rumble in the Jungle. Not yet the DR Congo, just an 8-round main attraction. She danced on the side stage. She sang a song in Yoruba that someone taught her as a child. She died at 80 in 2003 and didn't look a day over 65. In 1974, she's 50. 15 forgotten years hidden within her beehive. I like the way her hair is still a natural color. In the documentary, she appears for a mere moment, but it's brown instead of the blues and red she'd wear later. Yet still, red, red lips dance to the guttural and diabetic beats, as if she wasn't Jesus Comforia, as if she wasn't another reminder that the stages that day were coal dark and the balcony seats seemed more bleached than the mezzanine. But she was there, and she sang a song in Yoruba that she'd been practicing as a child, and at least there was a mezzanine. She was there, smaller and swifter than the boxers, but no less a fighter for it. Fidel called her a black menace, her smile a too joyful tune about escape to Yankee fame, but it's been over 6 years since Celia Cruz got buried in the Bronx, dirt from Havana in a box at her breast. She never escaped Cuba, not really. She never wanted to. At the funeral, her cotton-headed husband sang a song in Yoruba he knew she loved as a child. They took her body to Miami for a quick adios, and 100,000 mourners blew her kisses, whispering Guantanameras like Ave Marias, locking their palms and asking for relics. Cubanos, Panameños, Colombianos, Mexicanos, and Gringos. The mezzanine in full force, no side stages needed. It's been over 6 years since Celia Cruz died, and I can't believe I never knew she was there. The film lingers on her for just a minute, and for 60 seconds, George and Muhammad faded out under a score of lively drums, purple plumage, a golden microphone embedded in the greatest of cleavage. Ali won the match, the money, the fame at home. In 1974, she'd been gone for Havana for 12 years. They called her a queen in Zaire, the dancing woman of Cuba, and now the gloves the greatest wore that day sit in a museum case in Washington, but she was there. Some nights a voice still booms through Havana, singing a melody in Yoruba that it loved as a child. The Whackness. I keep having imaginary conversations with ex-lovers in the car about how they're doing, what they're up to, you know, checking in. There's a dog bed on the highway on the Aspinwall exit. It's been there for a year, this smushed polyester bed built for a Yorkie or a Scottie or a Pug or five. Sometimes I imagine they think of me, my ex-lovers, with a smile. Sometimes I imagine they hate me, or worse, they've forgotten. I don't understand why no one picks up that stupid dog bed, but I can't manage to stop on an off-ramp to do it myself. I imagine my exes sitting next to me, and I ask them all to reach out to grab that stupid bed, because really, what's it doing on the highway? And even in my imagination, they look at me with a mixture of pity and fear, because we all know that, damn, I got the strange. And sometimes I think my strange will consume me, that I wear it like the ugly guy at the bar wears desperation, that something about me will always scream, whoa, and not in a Keanu Reeves kind of way, you know? And sometimes I'm lucky enough to find someone that'll be fascinated long enough that I can pretend to be the best version of myself until one day I become who I pretend to be, like we all inevitably hope we do. But I'm too much of a narcissist to believe my own self-pity, although I can't stop wearing it like a maudlin condom, suffocating me, because hello, some people are allergic to latex, and why are they making condoms I fit into anyway? I suppose I'm afraid that, like some porn actresses and strippers, the combination of egocentric tendencies with my poor decision-making and reactions have led me down a shame spiral that will culminate in my dying alone and unloved. But I guess if Eddie Murphy can attempt to come back, it isn't below me to try too. Maybe if I got a stick with a hook at the end or a fishing pole, I could drive slow and someone could try to finally rid the highway of that molded and gross dog bed. I can't actually call them, you know. I can't call my ex-lovers and ask them why I'm flawed. They wouldn't say, or they'd be too hung up asking questions like, how did you get my number? And, lady, I don't know who you think I am. Which isn't a question, I suppose. I make up a story about the dog bed. A woman's dog has died and she is sad. On her way home after seeing her dog for the last time, she angrily throws the bed out the car window near the exit sign, thinking perhaps that everything has its off-ramps. And now each day she drives by and sees it, a reminder of what she's lost, of who she imagined she could be. Maybe it's just a reminder of how strange life is, how much strange we all got in us, and how the whackness of it never stops. It's just whack. Wiggity, wiggity, whack. I keep having imaginary conversations with ex-lovers in the car. They say that jokes should be funny, should make sense, should make you laugh. They don't have enough strange in them, I guess.
So we have time for one more short one. Can you read us one of those?
Let us pray. We define ourselves in books. Fortune-telling, birthday book, Bible, meaning and names, encyclopedia of dreams, astrology for beginners. We imagine it's all true. This is why we rub fingers until skin splits like mica. This is why our brows hurt as we furrow ourselves into deep anger. This explains the alphabetizing, the categorizing, the dishes piled in the sink. Today they say, you are blithe. Tomorrow we will crumble. We are a boar and a virgin, the beast and his bride, a moon rising beneath a house, fractured lines of life and love, immortals trapped in space and the truths contained in folded dough. We seek solace in books, definition in text. We pray that the gods are wrong. May we never crumble.
The poetry of Adriana Ramirez. Thank you so much for being here.
Thank you. It's been a great pleasure.
You've been listening to Prosody, a weekly show featuring the work of poets and writers. Writers appearing on Prosody also have their work showcased in Chapter and Verse, a bi-weekly feature in Pittsburgh City Paper, the arts entertainment newsweekly published every Wednesday. Prosody is produced by Jan Beatty and Ellen Wadey. Our sound engineers are Michelle Stoner and Lisa Alexander. Please tune in at our new time, Saturday mornings at 6:30, for Prosody 90.5 FM.